This is a special report from American Radio Works, The Roots of Resentment, America, Great Britain, and the Arab World. I'm Deborah Amos. Why are they so angry at us? Is a question asked with increasing intensity in the months since September 11th. In the Arab world, the answer is layered in centuries of history, an archaeology of occupation and defeat. It starts today with the latest news from the West Bank on Arab satellite TV, and is steeped in decades of strife. The Gulf War of 1991.
This attack has sent a shockwave through Baghdad.
The Arab-Israeli Wars of 1973. Of 1967.
Rebel Arabs everywhere. The enemy this morning launched an aggression on our Arab land and everything.
And of 1948.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against.
And those are only the layers of the last 53 years. We sent reporter Sandy Tolan to Egypt and Jordan to investigate Arab anger towards the West and how it's rooted in the events of the day and in long-ago history.
Beneath the decades of battles in the modern Middle East lies a far bloodier past, more than eight centuries previous. In 1098, European armies wearing crosses of cloth on their backs rode down from the north. The Crusaders marched for God and for territory. Crossing Syria en route to Jerusalem, they laid siege to the cities, killing tens of thousands. The next year, they arrived in Jerusalem with vengeance that lives on in the collective Arab memory. "One rode in blood up to one's knees," wrote a Christian witness, "and up to the horse's reins." The Muslim scribes told a similar story.
The population of the holy city was put to the sword, and the Crusaders spent a week massacring Muslims. They killed more than 70,000 people at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Here in Cairo, a city built on 70 centuries of history, the past bleeds out of stone. School children play at the Citadel of Salah ad-Din, the beloved Muslim Sultan who took back Jerusalem from the rampaging Christians in 1187, raising up Islam and the Arabs. Salah ad-Din was known for his just treatment of Christians and Jews in the city of three great faiths. His death left a vacuum, a centuries-long yearning for a new hero.
The legend will not go away easily. It triggers a feeling of pride, a feeling of strength.
Yusuf Shaheen is one of Egypt's cultural giants. A member of Egypt's Christian minority, Shaheen is director of dozens of films, including Salah ad-Din.
When they go back and they say Salah ad-Din, they're trying to find somebody who's as honorable, as charitable, as tolerant, as great as Salah ad-Din, to cover the feeling of, I feel measly. I feel I'm nothing.
Shaheen speaks of the historical weight of accumulated defeat from the Crusades forward, the occupation by the Europeans beginning two centuries ago, the birth of modern Israel in 1948, and the Arab-Israeli wars that followed, the Gulf War with Iraq, U.S.-led sanctions, and the deaths of thousands of Iraqi children, blood spilling endlessly in the occupied territories. In short, countless humiliations among a people proud of their history, their contributions to art, science, literature, music. You could feel this powerful mix of pride and defeat all over Cairo, across religion and class. Outside the Hussein Mosque and down the narrow cobbled walkways of the ancient bazaar, and the shopkeepers presiding over mounds of spices and rows of silver, cheap cassettes and tiny glass decanters. You could feel it out on the boulevards where appliance shop TVs blare tales of Aladdin recycled via Disney, past the McDonald's, the pubs and the cabarets. And down a potholed alley in a poor section of town, and inside to a warm welcome where you can feel it at the modest home to three generations. First things first, Arab hospitality, chocolate cake and cola for the visitors. In the tiny living room, tacked onto the peeling walls, posters evoking Eden, an elegant fountain in front of a mansion, wild animals tamed in play. The family's shoes are tucked neatly under a chair. The women are covered, so is the 9-year-old girl. The men speak.
We are proud. We have dignity. But your attitude makes us feel like we are third-class citizens.
Go back to your history books. You will see that the Islamic civilization preceded you. We helped create your Western civilization.
When Osama bin Laden swore by God there would be no peace in America until there was peace in Palestine, he brought home an issue that's part of our Muslim consciousness. And America is to be blamed for this problem. That's why there is sympathy for bin Laden.
This working-class Muslim family grew up knowing that the holy city of Jerusalem is under the control of Israel. But Jerusalem is the home of Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam, the place liberated by Salah ad-Din from the Crusaders centuries ago. Bin Laden, denouncing a new wave of Crusaders, comparing himself to Salah ad-Din, taps something deep. But so do the battles from the occupied West Bank every night on television.
These images build up inside. Forget about Muslim or Christian. As a human being seeing another suffering and oppressed in his home, and America is silent. But if something happens in a Western country, the world is shaken upside down. So what do you expect from us? We are definitely full of rage.
The anger is directed at American policy, especially U.S. support for Israel. Does this mean Muhammad and Walid and Magda and Aya frowning thoughtfully, sipping at their Cokes, passing the baby from knee to knee? Does this mean they hate America itself? Not exactly.
America is a great country. It's the land of opportunity. I wish I could go there. It's everybody's dream.
Muhammad says he loves American movies. Stallone and Schwarzenegger are his favorites, though it does seem strange how one person can fight a whole army and defeat them. The 5-year-old has something to say. She likes Hollywood too. Thinks it's funny when the boys kiss the girls. Thinks it's a shame we have so many car crashes. Feels sad when she sees other children getting killed so many nights on the news.
We still look up to America, but if the situation continues, I hate to say it, but all Muslims could turn into Osama bin Laden.
You needn't visit the poor, the working class, or even the devout to tap a deep well of Arab anger at the West, and the United States especially. It's everywhere you look. A literary salon and cafe on a back alley near downtown Cairo, midnight. Around the tables, glass water pipes with long cloth hoses. Smoke hovers. Two friends gather over strong Arabic coffee every Tuesday. Syed, a columnist for a Cairo daily, and Madame Hayat, a French tutor. Tonight, the subject is the U.S. attack on Afghanistan. It's the bee against the elephant, Syed says. Again, the U.S. is flexing power against sad, miserable people. Madame Hayat stares up with clear blue eyes. It's like this more and more, she says, now that there's only one superpower.
We reached a point of boiling. We are treated by the American as bugs, as insects.
Madame Hayat spent years as an actress in Cairo's lively political cabarets, lampooning the government. They'd perform in the parks and cafes until Egyptian intelligence under Presidents Sadat and then Mubarak censored them or threw them in jail. This was in the 70s and early 80s. There was a spirit of change in the air back then, she says. Now, only a deepening sense of grievance. Never did she dream that the means of change would shift to radical Islam. Never did she imagine the day she'd be told by the Americans to choose between Bush and bin Laden.
I don't think I have to choose between two demons. I'm against both. I really hate bin Laden, but nowadays I really dream a lot of me having two bombs. I would use these two bombs to destroy the Pentagon and the White House, and I would not think of
bin Laden.
Bin Laden.
Even I am against the terrorism.
Even though that I'm against terrorism, but they created a terrorist in her.
I feel. It's my feeling.
There is a disappointment on behalf of America.
the respected Egyptian political analyst Mohammed Sid Ahmed.
America sees itself as having defects, perhaps, but fundamentally a successful society and a successful enterprise. It does not understand why the others don't see it the same way. America is a powerful state, is a very rich country, can be self-satisfied in these terms, does not understand that other societies that have very serious problems don't look at America the way America looks at itself.
As deep as this frustration at the West is, it also serves in some ways as a deflection from anger at events closer to home. In Egypt, criticism of the state is tightly controlled. Political demonstrations are small, infrequent, and restricted to universities. The president's accomplishments are the subject of fawning news coverage while he runs for re-election unopposed. Police or soldiers seem to be on virtually every corner.
There are dictatorial regimes that thwart the growth of any rational opposition.
The Islamic thinker and author Abdul Wahab al-Masiri.
Look at the situation here in Egypt. They demolished the Labour Party. Now the rational opposition that could, through interaction with the government, could have developed, matured. It was not given the chance. So what you have is phenomena like that. Terrorists, naive people who have visions, and they become leaders. So it's really the Arab elites supported by the American administration.
This relationship of the U.S. and the Arab elites, al-Masiri argues, is a legacy of European colonialism, which began when Britain and France arrived in the 19th century to start carving up the Arab world. It's a time al-Masiri knows something about. For years, before becoming disillusioned with Western values and embracing Islam, he taught 19th century poetry at Rutgers.
The world bequeathed to us by the West since the mid-19th century is a Darwinian world. The only constant, the only absolute value is power. This is the mechanism to resolve conflicts. This is the mechanism that propels history. This is how you define morality. This is how you define meaning. If you have power, you do what you want. And people have been learning that from the West.
And now that power, he says, is transferred in part to Arab governments, who stand in between the desires of their people and the mandates of the superpower.
Like all Arab elites, they are frightened because the street was simmering already. There's one important factor that came into the picture now.
Arab news, he says, the new satellite networks, especially Al Jazeera.
We sit every day to see and simmer and get humiliated. Ordinary people, upper class girls, bourgeois, everyone is angry. And the elites know that. They had to move to protect themselves.
And so the criticism spurts out like steam from a calibrated valve, turned open for Israel, shut off for Egypt, adjusted somewhere in between for the powerful benefactor and lone superpower. One afternoon in the Han al-Khalili market in Old Cairo, this all comes sharply into focus. I'm accompanied by a minder from the Egyptian Press Center. If I want to interview regular people on the street, the government says, I'll need an escort. He writes down what I ask, what the people on the street say in response. It quickly becomes clear I'll need to take our interviews inside and away from scrutiny. But before that happens, a young woman approaches me. She's very Western-looking, with moussed hair and designer jeans. She spotted the microphone and is nearly bursting with what's inside her. Ignoring the government man, she blurts it out.
America, maybe this attack will wake up America. It's about time you feel our pain.
The man from the press center tells her, no, no, we don't want to say that. That's not the message we want to put out right now. She ignores him.
We've had terrorism for years. How come the world didn't act until America was hit?